What do you get when you combine mythology, stories from along the Silk Road, and epic fantasy? Hi, my name is Marko and welcome to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. My latest guest is R.R. Virdi. He had an inspiring journey to becoming a two-time Dragon Award finalist and a Nebula Award finalist. He's the author of multiple books, including the urban fantasy series The Grave Report and the acclaimed fantasy novel The First Binding, which is soon getting a sequel called The Doors of Midnight. We discuss the story of his road to recognition, experience with traditional publishing, inspirations and influences, as well as his process of creating his latest work, and many more. So, get comfortable and let's enjoy this week's Storyline session with R.R. Virdi. Hi Ronnie, welcome to Storyline Sessions, how are you?
I'm doing great, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. It's exciting. We'll soon be seeing your new book. I'm sure a lot of people watching are familiar with The First Binding, and I'm sure that we'll get into talks about that as well, but also a lot of about the Doors of Midnight, the follow-up. And for me, I'd like to start off from like the reception so far for the first one, because as we're looking forward to the launch of the next one, the first one did make a splash, and I'm sure you can be proud of what you did. But like, could you tell us a bit about your reactions to people reacting to it?
It's been really complicated, I guess, because when book one debuted, I had actually turned in the manuscript for book two the month before. So I didn't have as much time to sort of, I don't want to say enjoy, but perhaps react all the way as I thought I would, because of the scopes of the book and how large each one is. And book two's original draft was 450,000 words. To put in perspective, book one's was 350, so it was another 100,000 words larger, so another whole novel's worth. And it was a roller coaster ride, because book one had just come out, I went to Dragon Con to promote it, and I was going to other conventions, and then my editor actually vanished at Tor. There were a few authors at the time one editor represents multiple authors. We had no idea what happened. We were waiting for edits. People were freaking out. And the original timeline for book two to come out was actually October 2023. And then my editor was let go for having vanished. And then I got a new editor. So we started edits very late in, I want to say, just before summer 2023. But I was grinding and trying to wait and stuck in this limbo, because I didn't know what would be changed that might affect what I wanted to write with book three. So there's this whole process of simultaneously promoting, but also working hard to make up for the delays with book two that were out of my control. So I'm catching up with a lot of reactions. And because the hardcover did so well, they actually delayed the paperback release. Usually it's more common to get a paperback within 6 months, but the paperback came out 1 year later. So there was like a secondary like wave of new readers coming in because the paperback was so much more accessible. It's cheaper, it's easier to get a hold of. And now with the ramp up for book two coming, book one's paperback's moving even more. I guess like new people are becoming aware of it, which was something I'm also not used to. So it's kind of funny. I think I'm only just really starting to see the impact the book has made. Like its success. I didn't know how well it sold until really recently, actually, in terms of royalties. Like for my advance, how much the book's earned, I had no clue until recently, and it's done really well.
Yeah, congrats on that. I mean, I believe it's kind of stressful juggling both of those. But yeah, so did you just kind of, when did you start working on the second and third book? Did you kind of do it simultaneously? What was the thing?
So when book one was done, I already knew what I wanted book two to be, because when I first sold the series, I only had a sample of book one. Book one wasn't done, but they asked for not necessarily an outline, a synopsis. Like, what's the storyline for the first three books? And I told them how long the series was going to be. It's longer than three. And they asked for like a breakdown of like, if you did it in arcs, what would it look like? So I gave them that. So even though I don't outline because I'm a pantser, I do have a structural map similar to Robert Jordan, a technique he would do where he would have key fixed points he knows he's going to get to no matter what. And then as you write, you sort of narrow how you're going to get there because of events you've committed to. And I'm doing the same thing. So book two was somewhat easier to write. I've just started book three recently because of the delays that happened to book two, unfortunately, from publishing industry, COVID stuff, paper crisis, and then losing my editor. The process, I think, makes book three the easiest, because at this point, I've already committed to so much in the first two books, and I know what I need to nail for book three. It's more just making sure I do the rest of the research I want, because this series is very heavily inspired in a love letter to comparative storytelling, as well as comparative mythology. These are things I personally study. If I had had the money to go to college all the way, I probably would have pursued a PhD in mythology. It's a huge passion of mine. And I just want to make sure I use the mythology the right way while I reinvent it. Because a huge influence of mine is Tolkien, who used a lot of smaller European culture mythology. Obviously, you know, he used the Norse epics, and then he used, I believe, the Finnish one, the Kalevala. A lot of beats and nods and structural key points from them were reinterpreted to form Middle Earth. And I'm doing something very similar with famous stories and archetypes and tropes throughout the first binding from not just South Asian mythology, but along the Silk Road, which went from, obviously, East Asia all the way up to Portugal and Spain and Italy.
Yeah, and for me, it's really interesting going all the way back to Tolkien, but also looking more recently. I think we had like a huge time in the, let's say, industry, but like in storytelling, that a lot of people went to basically as a default to like kind of standard European-ish medieval or kind of, you know, eventually maybe they depend out to Norse, but like it was the main focus. And I think that we've recently seen a lot of people, as yourself, kind of reaching out beyond that, and kind of, that's why we're getting these different stories. And for me, I'm glad that's happening, because it kind of started blending in together, and we'll go into a lot of your influences there. But for me, that's really interesting. Also, a while back I had Zamil Akhtar, who is also doing something like going to his roots and something that's closer to him. And for me, it was really interesting hearing him when he said about like his descriptions and things like that. He said, yeah, people were like, why are you describing the house or in such a detail? But he was like, yeah, but for you, when you imagine a house, you imagine one type of house, but I wanted you to imagine a different kind of house that for me is more closer to home. So for me, that was really, really interesting. And yeah, the Silk Road, how did that came by? I mean, was that like a period in history that was interesting to you for some other reasons? How did you came by that?
Well, a lot of it has to be because, well, I was born in America, but my parents are obviously Indian. And growing up, a lot of Indian history is obviously rooted in the Silk Road. It was one of the countries at the center of it, including an oceanic Silk Road, which people didn't realize how much oceanic trade was done there. There was trade as far back as ancient Egypt, going through parts of the Red Sea, and the Indian monsoon winds. Actually, there's a historical story of a sailor being blown off course, and he's blown into this delta that led up through Egypt all the way up to Alexandria. And the Egyptians at the time, with the Roman influence, found him, and they were like, who's this guy? And he explained India and everything, and they're like, well, there's an oceanic trade route there? And he actually led an expedition back. And I, because of my history of studying storytelling mythology, you realize that trade was a huge influence in storytelling. I've done threads about how Buddhism influenced so much, and how the story of Hanuman journeyed to China and likely influenced the Monkey King a lot. It's not 100% solely responsible to it, but there's a lot of influence from it, just like how most people don't know this, but some Indian gods are still worshipped in Japan to this day, like Indra. He's the Indian storm god, but if you look into Japanese history, he's over there, but he arrived over there because of Buddhists and Buddhist travel. One of the world's first and oldest residential university where students could come and stay and live was called Nalanda. You can look this up. It was an Indian university, and it gained popularity again because of Buddhism. So Greek philosophers and people as far as Japan would come to study Buddhism, but it taught other things. It would teach physical development, like wrestling, martial arts. A lot of places had these kinds of things. It would teach philosophy, astronomy, as well as astrology, their idea of magic. I don't think anyone ever graduated practicing magic, but they tried. And this developed all throughout the history of India. And when I wanted to create a fantasy, it didn't make sense to me to remove such a huge trade aspect when I knew it influenced the culture so much. And I didn't want to write just an Asian fantasy. I wanted to have a larger epic and just do it through the lens of South Asia. So my character is South Asian. I can show a South Asian empire, but there's still a larger world. It's motivated by trade, because if this is a love letter to storytelling and epics from around the world, which share from each other and take and inspire, it didn't feel right to leave the rest of the world out of it. I wanted to try to do a very different take of just the world, but have something familiar, which is my version of India and then my pseudo Silk Road. And then I could do a fantasy around that.
It's really visible in your work, the combination of that. And also, as you said, like on one hand, you have the myths and the storytelling from around the world, but also have like the religion part of it, which kind of meshes together really well. And for me, it was interesting, like seeing that those two really do coexist, as you said, in the real world as well, that they are part of the storytelling. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that, like introducing myths and legends, I can imagine like a lot of things. I mean, we won't spoil anything, but even in the second book already, but when we get to the later parts of the series, the setup with some of the myths and things we learn in the first binding, I can imagine that will come into play. Was that something that like you wanted to base it on intentionally, or did it come mm-hmm. later?
That was one of the roots, because the whole story is about the idea of storytelling, and some readers have caught on to how in the first book there's overt comments from Ari and others that maybe all these stories are inspired by the same one, or the original one. And Ari serves as a vehicle for that, as there are clearly obvious people who have twisted his story, but obviously he's looking for some, and the idea that myths have done that. But in our world, it's the exact same thing. There's a story later on about the birth of Radivan in book one. And it's analogs, obviously, the Christian virginal birth of Christ. However, people don't know that birth. There's an older story that's similar in South Asia, and it's the birth of Karan, who's one of the main characters in the South Asian epics. And his mother, Kunti, is given a boon by the sun god Surya, and I use a solar deity as well, and she gives a virginal birth to a prince. So it's a very similar story, and I've seen that this has happened in our world so much. And we also have a history of heroes and conquerors in our world being inspired by heroes and conquerors before them. Whether you're inspired by myths and characters like Achilles, or you're inspired by a real character like Alexander the Great, it didn't make sense to remove that from a fantasy world, because culture, as different as it is country to country, the very act of how humans interpret and interact with their own culture is very similar. We have our cultural legends that we're going to copy or be inspired by, or some myths that warn us of things. It's a very human-centric thing. And if this whole thing is about storytelling, I didn't want to change how humans interact with story. I wanted to make that the foundation of, this is just a new fantasy, but I'm going to show similar stuff of how we've always just been with stories.
And how challenging was it, like, giving that, like, meta layer, like, writing stories within stories and, like, talking about storytelling while doing storytelling? I can imagine that's, like, something in the movie when, like, an actor plays an actor who kind of acts a different role. For me, that layer is really interesting.
It was so hard. I had to not just read every epic I could find my hands on, but I had to start reading history of storytellers. Like, who actually retold those stories? How did performers tell these stories? And then how did those performers tell the story of that performer? And interestingly, one thing I noticed, which is really funny, is how comedians actually, especially in the modern day, now do their sets. A lot of them aren't just telling jokes. They're making their stories humorous. They tell a lot of anecdotes or events. Okay, I was at this party one time and whatever. And then you see other comedians piggyback and sometimes talk about stories with that comedian. So that kind of became like a more modern pop culture way of me adapting and taking this. It just gave me a better frame reference of how visually I could see it and then try to adapt it for storytelling, if that makes sense. So there was a lot of historically how it's done, watching and reading a lot of frame narratives, and then trying to find out just how performers do that. There was a lot of good YouTube stuff on watching the history of storytelling, which is very different than obviously writing a novel. It's more about how people perform orally and then how those tales evolved, how lyricism evolved, and how certain also language traits within evolved too. There's a great example of how at one point in the English language, the word life and death actually sounded very similar. It was leaf and deeth back in Chaucer's age. And then by the time it got to Shakespeare's age, English had changed so much. Most of Shakespeare's writing still rhymes today, but Chaucer's doesn't. There was a larger change of language between Chaucer and Shakespeare's time than from Shakespeare's to ours. So there was also that narrative, too, of if I'm going to tell classic stories, am I going to change the names and languages of places over a certain time period that might be different than today? How do I take that into account in the present story, or even Ari's past versus the past of some legends, and then make sure there's enough clues for things to add up or there's consistency? And it required a lot of free writing. I don't outline, but every story that actually exists in the novels, that's what I actually had to write out by hand first. So a lot of my drafting is actually creating the legends and the myths, because that's what I actually use as my world building versus perhaps maybe a Sanderson writer who does like a larger magic system world building instead. I'll do mine based off storytelling. What are the foundational myths that people retell and tell and then inspire their heroes and cultural legends?
And going back to that, you mentioned clues. You leave a lot of like breadcrumbs for people, and like I can imagine everything will pan out over the trilogy, and a lot of things that people are still picking up on, even though we're nearing the release of the second book, people are commenting on some stuff in the first one. And as a pantser, how tough was it setting those things up? Because you know, I can imagine that like logic between the arcs in the story needs to be tight, and like when you go back to the were there many rewrites, or just like how does that work as a pantser?
Thankfully not many rewrites, but it's as I'm pantsing, maybe it's wrong to call myself a pantser, it's very odd, I don't have a structurally written outline down on paper, but I've been writing so long and I still study structure religiously that I'm just able to do it a lot in my head. But what I said is one of my inspirations is Robert Jordan, and he would still write down scenes far ahead. Like, if he had an idea for book 6, he'd write, like, maybe a chapter or maybe even a scene, like, Rand's gonna do this, it's super cool. I know that's gonna happen in book 6, so I can start setting it up now, even when I'm pantsing, and then I have to make sure just when I get there, I commit to that. And one of the big secrets of writing and editing is, once you've written it, not only can you just go back and tweak it, but you can reference it later. This is something that the author of One Piece is very famous from, where if he writes something, he consistently goes back and read his own work, and he'll go, what can I pick up back on that I wrote? Maybe you write an accidental throwaway character in book 1 and you didn't think they were important, but if you sit down while writing book 2 and go, well, what would have happened to them in this time? You might find ways that they were relevant, and then by capitalizing them at book 2, it looks like you had set that up intentionally the whole time. It feels like a cop-out, but it's really not, because that's still a developed skill to understand, to go, can I use this that I introduced before again? And my process is usually just a combination of all of those. There was a character in book 1 that I don't want to say that had a lesser role, and by book 2 I realized I'd already set them up to capitalize on that role. So I knew if I did that, it's just a better reward for everybody. And if I didn't, no one would care, but it was an opportunity to take, so why not? Because it adds that depth, character interaction, and now it might give me something to do more with later on.
And thinking about those characters and POVs, how does that change over the course of your series? Do you think that like it's something that will like shift dramatically, or do you want to keep it tight and get stay closer to Arya and like maybe just keep the tone same as it was?
I think for this particular series, I always wanted to keep it as close to Arya as I can, because part of it is, since it's a picaresque, I want to focus on showing his lens to the world. And this might come from a point of either, I guess, consideration or respect, but because it's Silk Road and he's going to go through so many cultures, I always worried, and I didn't want him to become the representative for those cultures. That happens a lot in fiction, where you have a foreign character who might speak in a way as if they are 100% able to comment on other cultures. And I didn't want that. I wanted Ari to at least have the perspective of, you know, he's an outsider in many places, so all you're really seeing is his interpretation, and you know it's his interpretation. So he can't speak for a different culture at large, but he can speak to his perception of what he's going through in that culture or environment. Because book 2 follows that as well. There's a period of time where he's completely displaced in a whole other part of the world. And he's receiving information from another culture, another way of doing things. And it's not Itania, which we've already been introduced to, and it's not his home, the Mutt of the Empire. So he's really a fish out of water. And keeping it close to his POV means that you can sort of keep that lens of, he's a foreigner, he's an outsider. He still doesn't know everything, so even as the audience, be really careful what you assume is a larger truth, or this is the way everyone does something in this part of the world. It's just what he's experiencing, and that's what's he's gonna have to internalize and build off of that, for better or worse.
And when we are hearing like his past and stories he's been told, and he's like remembering stuff, and kind of that almost unreliable narrator moments we get, how did you go about thinking about stuff that's going to happen in the future versus his like past, and when he's like talking about more recent things, and compared to that like in the first book when he's a kid, did you like split them up, how that from the craft side of things? How did you think about those two narratives?
I kind of thought about it in terms of, there's a really great, I don't remember the lines exactly, but of the character Lug, who's from European mythology, Celtic, Irish, and I remember reading where there's a little passage where he kind of introduces himself, and this is something done by a lot of heroes throughout mythology, but also more modern fiction. In fact, you might have heard of like how in a lot of even anime or fiction, there's a character where if you're about to duel or kill somebody, it's like, who are you? Give me your name and your deed so I know who I'm really killing. And am I wasting my time? Like, who have you beaten? What have you done? What have you accomplished? It's almost like a braggart list. In fact, recently I was rereading Dresden Files, and Jim Butcher does this as well, where in the most recent Dresden Files books, Harry's fighting, I can't remember, I think it's a giant or a troll. And the troll asks Harry, like, who are you? Tell me your name so I know who I have the pleasure of killing. And Harry lists himself and all his things of, like, everything he's accomplished. He's like, who the hell are you? And the troll or giant goes, like, I fought the Odin Sun and lived. And Harry's like, oh, crap. So what I created for Ari was almost like this bragging list. What are things that he's accomplished? And then I know what I can use to sort of set him up in the future and go, the past story in some way has to lead up to either fulfilling that, subverting it because we know he's an unreliable narrator, or commenting it in some way. And that sort of became like a loose skeletal outline because it's given me little legends to fulfill. So instead of plot points, a lot of the story is fulfilling Ari's claims or subverting them or showing how he fell short of them. And it's not a traditional outline. I wouldn't recommend using that, but it works very well for picaresques. You know, like if you're writing something like Don Quixote, which is a picaresque, about like an adventure story following a larger than life character or someone in pursuit of that. So what I did for Ari originally in the two past timelines was, who is he seen as in the world today, whether he shares that with you or by the world? And what did he accomplish or believe he accomplished or says in the past? And if you have these two contrasting or similar lists, it sort of gives you little checklists of what to hit off and build story points to. And if you do it right, you get what is, if not a climax, you can at least get an emotional catharsis, which is something romance does really well, where you don't have to have a big action scene, but you do something that you built up so emotionally over the novel, it's really fulfilling to get to that point.
Yeah, for sure. I get what you're saying. And for me, it's also interesting when I read the introduction to the second book, I had this like moment when I reread it and like thinking about his lies, because that's like an emphasis on that. And for me, it was like putting the first one in a different context almost. I was like, okay, are we going to get something that's like twisted around from the first one? And yeah. I think that you can get that from that, as you said, and it's really a good point. I also listened a while back to a writer who said like he also doesn't like plot it all the way. He gets those points, as you mentioned, because mm-hmm. it's an interesting thing. He said if you plot it all the way through and then you need to get just in to tie it all up, you're an employee of your former self, and it's you're left all the fun work in that place, and you're just like, now I'm doing the chores. So for me, yep. that makes a lot of sense, especially for a story like this.
100%. And I don't know, I don't want to comment for other people, it might be a mental health thing, but for me it definitely is, because I have ADHD. So I know what I'm motivated by, and I'm motivated by the new and the exciting. So if I did leave it too rigid, I wouldn't have motivation to finish books. In fact, when I started, I was an outliner because I thought you had to. I never finished an outline novel in my life because I was like, oh, I already know it all. And halfway through every book, I just stopped. I don't even know why. I got bored. And the second I pantsed, I started finishing every book. Every single book I ever wrote, I've been able to finish pantsing.
And do you still manage to surprise yourself?
Oh, absolutely. The first book had so many surprise twists, even though I was using certain mythology. I was like, do I really want to commit to this? And when I thought yes, I had to go back and go, well, why? And then I realized, oh, I can use this as a commentary for shared storytelling. I can use this as a commentary for comparative mythology. I can use this as a commentary for this trope or this beat or this archetype. And then it became more meta-referential as I was writing it. And that became really, really like satisfying to see, because the whole point of Ari's life and his adventures and his commentary is searching for stories, talking about stories inspiring one another, commenting that they all come from the same source. And then I studied Proto-Indo-European mythology and how much that influenced from the names of gods and cultures and some of the stuff we talked about shared gods. The series sort of became a giant love letter to that, what human nature in sharing stories. And then Ari became, in effect, a proto-hero, replicating a lot of stories from our world and then within the context of his own world, even though I'm using mythology and fiction from ours to write that. So it became like a conversation piece within its own self, as well as within the history of storytelling. And that like completely changed how I looked at it as I was writing it, and it made it more fun for me to even like bleed in more mythology and center even more on storytelling.
Yeah, for sure. And when you mentioned also like the urban fantasy and things like that, and a lot of things that are influencing you and some of the things you worked on before aren't traditionally like high fantasy or epic fantasy or stuff like that. And how did that play in, like, when you approach something like these books, how does your approach differ? Like, what do you take from those things before, from sci-fi, from urban fantasy? And what is kind of like when you write a book as The Doors of Midnight, do you like try to forget those things that you use there as a mechanism, or how is it the process for you then?
Fortunately, because of my love of urban fantasy, which also comes from mythology, I was able to take a lot of what I did with the Grave Report specifically, because that was inspired by both the Dresden Files as well as a TV show called Supernatural. And something I loved about that show was it would take mythology, but it would twist how it worked. Like, you would take characters you know, but they readapted how they work in that world. And they were close enough to be familiar, but unique and different. And when I saw that, I always loved that technique, and what I wanted to do was something similar. And like what I said, what Tolkien did, where he took very European myths and he just sort of reinterpreted them for Middle Earth, but then he also added it to be more quintessentially British than perhaps Norse, perhaps more than Finnish too. And I wanted to do the same thing, so I took some of my urban fantasy skills and how I approached mythology, and keeping it similar enough to be accessible, but also maybe going harder in terms of how am I showing it to be different? What are the evolution or tweaks here? And while my structure for the novel is different than my urban fantasy, I still believe in something that I learned from Jim Butcher, which was, again, the catharsis point. Understanding how to hit that where everything you write is a promise and a build-up to that moment. And it doesn't have to, again, be the action climax. Like, there's a sort of arguable climax in book one, the first binding, where Ari's on top of a mountain and he has an epic scene. But then after that, there's an emotional catharsis where he's back at school and he fulfills one of his legends, which I don't know if I can spoiler that because the book's really old at this point now, or old enough, but he fulfills something that he promised to do. Because earlier on in the book, he actually says he wanted to chase his own legend, he wanted to follow in the footsteps of Brahm, and he wanted to bind fire. That's no different than Use the Force, Luke. Where we're introduced very early on to Luke learning about this mystical force. It's in his bloodline. His father had it. That he might be able to learn, and then he pursues it, and then for like maybe like the third act of the movie, he doesn't really do much with it when he's on the Death Star, right? It's Obi-Wan who's carrying it there. He fights Vader, and Luke has that loss, and then he goes back to being a pilot. But his culmination of his story arc in the first one is finally getting to the end, and it's Use the Force. That's the emotional catharsis. He does that whole, like, okay, I'll trust it this time, and puts away the targeting computer, and then the reward is he makes the unsinkable shot where he blows up the Death Star. That's a combination of both. He gets the emotion of using the Force, and he still has a cool action scene. In the first book, I broke it up. I wanted two separate acts. One that represented the physical, which was his whole scene on the mountain, and was more action-y. And then one that was like a payoff for the promise of what Ari's really chasing, which is this magic, this ethereal force and legend. And that also still comes from the urban fantasy, even if the structure of the book until then is very different.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's like when you lay it out, like hearing that, it's really interesting, because I think that a lot of people aren't sure how to mix those things, and people are, I mean, I don't like to categorize things strictly by genre, but I know that a lot of people, it's easier for them to kind of grasp it. But speaking of genre, I think that you also talked a lot about that in some of your other interviews, but like writing to genre and writing to market, I think that like you as someone who has like experience with self-publishing, the trade publishing, and writing in multiple genres, what was so far in your career like a takeaway when we discuss writing stories that like are important to you, but also find that balance with something that readers want to see?
Oh man, I think that's hard, and I think in some ways I'm still struggling because the market's always adapting, and this is true indie and traditional. Indie, you might have more chance of writing to market and trend because you can write and publish faster, but those changed overnight too. And the fact of Cozy Fantasy that started indie, with Travis Baldry, who self-published Legends and Lattes and blew it up, and now indies have been doing it fast and traditional's been acquiring it. But I don't know how fast those trends will last in either market, because more than ever we can publish faster and more now, which means you can oversaturate faster than ever now. For using that as an example, I know for a fact that traditional has been buying Cozy Fantasy since the breakout of Legends of Lattes in such a high volume that by the time they come out, maybe in 2 to 3 years the whole genre's burned out because they bought so much of it, and there'll just be a year or two where non-stop cozies. I don't know. I'm more leery of it now. I do understand and I believe that there is an importance of understanding genre expectations. Romance is the best example. It has been historically the most formulaic genre, even before indie publishing happened. It was always, you know, you have the happily ever after ending. Harlequin built an entire empire off very formulaic romances, which is good and bad because it means readers know what they're getting. And they want that. It's like buying a Hershey bar, a specific one, right? You don't want the almond one. You don't want dark chocolate. You want this specific one. This gives you sort of a tool guide to a writer of how to execute that because you have so many formulaic novels to study. And as a reader, you get exactly what you want if that's what you want. I think there's benefits and dangers to that just depending on your personality type. If you're really happy and you're fulfilled doing that, then you might as well because what's there to lose? You have an inbuilt market to target. You have enough structure to understand how to execute this, and the rest is practice. And you're probably going to have some level of guaranteed sales, and you're happy doing it. I struggle with writing to market, so my biggest thing has been focusing more on craft execution of the story I want, in the hopes of, I suppose, relying in this case on just larger genre trends, which is fantasy itself is still pretty popular overall within SFF. There's enough room in fantasy that, as saturated as it gets, there's enough diversity in styles of fantasy that they're always going to be fans of. And an example of this right now is traditional is really suffering under a print size crunch. I'm kind of surprised I'm still allowed to publish the size of books I am, and I think it's because I got in at the last second, to be honest. It was dumb luck. Because new authors I know are getting some hard cap word counts of like 100k or 120, which is like 1/4 the size of mine. But I still believe there is a very hardcore fandom for the large epics. And those have always been structured very differently. Game of Thrones, for example, not just in tone, but its climaxes is very different than Robert Jordan's, right? One is a low fantasy, one is a lot more cutthroat. And the climaxes per novel aren't necessarily an epic story climax, they're character climaxes, right? You're not going to have Rand saving the world or a whole battle, a whole book built to the battle, like The Great Hunt, of watching Rand sort of defeating somebody. And then the world thinks he's the dragon reborn before book three. Like, enough people see him in the sky having that fight. Versus, in Game of Thrones, it might be the death of Eddard Stark. And you realize a political rebellion's about to happen, but it's a very one-character POV, but he's not the main character. And both are brilliant for that. And I think the overall fantasy genre allows you to sort of get away with a little bit more in how you structure it, as long as you're paying off what you promised in your books. And that's going to change genre to genre. Thrillers are a very good example also. There's a lot of formulaic thrillers that follow sort of the Jack Reacher style or the detective mystery of how you go about your beat per beat per beat to the resolution. And that can be very good and bad depending on where you want to write. Because the larger successes of thrillers happen to be that they're very easy to read, they're accessible, they're fast, they have a huge airport market, right? A lot of people pick up a John Grisham novel in an airport and finish it on their flight to somewhere or at least between all their flights back and forth. And that, again, gives you a good market to hit and the structure, but it might not be the crime thriller you want to write. For me, I think it's just been a struggle because I don't like genre conventions. But that's a very me issue thing, right? And like I said, there's pros and cons to that.
No, for sure. But thinking about the conventions and the length of your novels, as you mentioned, I know a lot of people recently that I spoke to have kind of been slowly trying to just like push through those boundaries and be like, but I need to tell this story. And in the like fantasy canon, we do have a lot of epics, as you said, which are quite large and like long books, and people don't mind it. I mean, a lot of people gravitate towards them exactly for that reason, because they do have a story that's kind of broad in scope. And you also mentioned in some of your talks that like you had back and forth with your editor about like putting a lot of stuff in, and just like you have both of those things that a lot of people would advise against. You have a long book and you also have like descriptive scenes because of the contents and the type of story that you're saying. The picture, and you have like a lot of lyrical stuff in there as well, and I can imagine that could be a struggle with your editor, so maybe speak about that a bit.
Oh yes, absolutely. And part of it also is like what you said before, what Zamir was talking about. A lot of POC authors have talked about this, and in fact a great example comes from a white author, Jen Leons. She actually had this at a convention with me where you could tell somebody the knight was riding on their mount towards a castle. And if you say that, they have a very typical, okay, it's a male knight on a horse riding to a European castle. But you never said that. It could absolutely be an Asian knight wearing their armor on a fantastical beast riding to a castle looks more like an Indian temple, for example. And there's so much of a certain kind of fantasy that it becomes easy to take it for granted what somebody means. So when you're trying to show a whole nother world, there is going to be a lot of extra description showing the differences of that, because what is normal or something to me, or at least I'm exposed to, might not be to somebody else. So you don't want it to be just taken for that granted of, oh, they're wearing clothing that is not what I'm actually writing. Like, there's a reason why I have certain clothing styles, and a lot of characters in my world have beards, and that's because of a long time ago, that was actually really common. Different kinds of beards, like, people forget there's an industry around that. Like, people had scented beards, like, you'd have oils, natural fragrant oils, you just, like, you know, wrap through your beard to keep it clean and smelling. Nice small little cues of hairstyles, clothing styles and cuts, just like today, if someone wears a cheap suit that's ill-fitting versus an expensive one, you notice that. Characters do that even in fantasy worlds. Historically, you have cuts of clothing that are different, and they matter. Colors of things matter. Clothing and hairstyle choice matters, especially in a very broad and different world. And especially when I'm riding along the Silk Road, where people are trading for that reason. They want to have different jewelry. They want to have different scented oils and perfumes. There's even a joke about this, because it'll come up later, but there's a country named Savon, and that's the French word for soap. And it's because this country is going to be trade-wise based off of the idea that there are people who used to sell scented oils and soaps and things for that. And it was just a little nod to French history and stuff, but a fantastical version of it. That's something they happen to cater to in this world, is focusing on that. And there are a lot of times where I'd go into that, and the art and music styles are very different, where for word count, they're like, you have to cut this. And I'm trying to explain that there's musical history that influences the world and different musical styles and instruments. So it was definitely a battle. Like, there's one thing I had to fight with, which was specifically the color of clothing that some people wore in the desert. And I wrote black, and it comes from a myth that they were like, shouldn't they be wearing white because white reflects more heat? And I was like, that's not true. White reflects some heat, but it actually doesn't reflect sunlight, which is what's damaging. So sunlight can actually, UV rays can penetrate white better than black, because the black clothing actually absorbs it and doesn't let it get to your skin. So you actually take less damage from the sun, like dryness, risk of heat stroke, risk of skin cancer. And the reason people wear layered black robes is the same principle as an igloo keeps heat in the cold because of air pockets. When you have heavy black robes, the heat builds up between the layers, but it filters back out through your sleeves. There's an actual history of the Bedouin make giant high canopy tents, really tall, of black camel hair. And the reason is hot air rises. So what it does is you sit on the ground very low, and the tent is extremely tall, and it creates an air pocket bubble that's really hot above you, so the air where you sit down here is cooler. And I had to really fight and explain that. Like, there's so many different cultural nods that are different in the world because of where people are and how they evolved. Book 2, this is not a spoiler, but there was a scene I had to sort of talk about where characters are eating something that's like a fruit roll-up. And I had to explain that in the desert, because of how you could dehydrate and preserve food, that people have actually had fruit leather, which is like a predecessor to fruit roll-ups for a long time, where you dehydrate and mash and roll, and then roll it back up like on a piece of parchment or something. You'd have like just dried apricot. And it was just like apricot leather, like jerky. And it was a really easy way to keep food that would store. So there is a lot of that, but you wouldn't expect that in a fantasy that was Western, because I think everyone's familiar with salt pork or something. Everyone does. That's how you preserve it. But you wouldn't have that really in Asia, with so many different spices and fruits and already that super hot climate, where people are used to preserving food a different way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And thinking about that, I believe that a lot of people who aren't familiar with the cultures that you are describing and adjacent things may find that, if they are like into world building and things like that, really exciting. And it's kind of weird hearing that a lot of editors are pushing for that to be removed. And I don't know, where's that coming from? I don't know, how was your experience with editors so far regarding that? What do you know where they come from with that?
I think it's because maybe editors still aren't used to it, which sounds really weird to say, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I think, like, if you go back even 10 years, the level of diversity in fiction still wasn't that much even 10 years ago. It's kind of gone through a boom more in the last 5 years. And I think there's so many other arbitrary things editors are forced to do because of print size and word count. They're looking for anywhere to cut. Like, editors by default want to cut stuff. And a lot of New York editors also, sorry to say, there's not a lot of diversity among them. In terms of background, education, maybe race, that you're going to have to really fight to explain, like, hey, this is where this is coming from and this is why. As much as, like, I know it's very nice and New York Publishing says it wants certain things out of diversity and other cultures and stuff, when you go online on Twitter and you see You can see a lot of authors from different backgrounds kind of saying their experiences haven't always lined up with that. And I don't know what other motivations they could have, because obviously I don't ever ask them, like, why are you doing this? That could probably cost a line. I just try to explain my side, like, hey, this is important, this is why. Book two has a lot of scenes with new bird mythology that shows up, or bird symbolism. And I had to explain why that's important. Someone figured this out from book one, so now I can talk about it. But there was a whole thing with sparrows in book one. And I was talking to some people, and they didn't seem to get it. They thought it was a Game of Thrones thing. And I tried to explain that there's an arc where Arya ties being a sparrow to a large amount of gold. And together, they sort of form this reference of like a golden sparrow. A sparrow who stole a lot of gold. And that's because one of India's nicknames used to be the Golden Sparrow. The place this takes place in only happens to be my Indian analog of a country, but on the map, the city he's in is nearly at the heart of India. So there's a little nod and reference using certain birds. A lot of ancient cultures obviously have a lot of symbolism with a lot of different animals. For anyone who's familiar with The Jungle Book, written by Rudyard Kipling, there was a lot of animal symbolism there too. Obviously, Mowgli identifies with wolves, bears, tigers, snakes, monkeys, and animal motifs have always been really important in South Asian culture. A lot of them have been anthropomorphized in mythology. We have Naga, which are serpent-like beings, very intelligent, capable of magic and shape-shifting. We have the Vanar, who are monkey people. And there's a lot of things like that. So even though I'm not representing them as people, I have a lot of different animal motifs that are going to show up for certain reasons. And I've had to explain that in great detail. Like, it's not just a cool, funny nod or just a fantasy name that I want to use for kicks and giggles. Here's mythology behind it. Here's how I'm actually going to secretly use it to sort of, you know, set stuff up or whatever, or what it's a commentary on. And it'll take more books to get through, but you'll see it. And then usually, in most cases, I've gotten to get my way.
And did you think about, like, adding an appendix of sorts, trying to, like, tie in some of the stuff? Or you like to stay as something that the readers should explore on their own?
I was hoping for the latter, like, readers exploring on their own, because I'm one of those readers, and I realized in some ways it might have added a level of inaccessibility to the work. I didn't think about that, because I was so excited, because my favorite books are like that, too. And I don't know if they were ever author intent, it was just they're written in a way where you go back and you keep rereading and you find new things. And I've always loved that. I thought that was actually an extra part of being a reader. Not every book has to do that, but it's like added value. A certain kind of book does that, and it's part of the fun of that. And I specifically wanted to write that kind of book where people go back and reread book one after reading book two. And by doing so, not only do you find new things, but I wrote it in a way where certain stories might change how you interpreted book one, which will change how you interpret book two after reading them again in that circle. And then book three will do the same thing, where it'll change book two and one, depending on stuff you learn and you missed context from. So it's not even the same story going forward. And I just really appreciate those kinds of readers because I'm finding them. There was a certain section which I can now talk about because I've seen some reviews where people have found it. It's chapter 10, Brahm, which is Ari reading an epic story to one of his childhood friends. And it's narrated with some normalized prose and then verse. There's rhyming couplets and quatrains all throughout it. And someone found out if you delete the normal prose and you leave all the rhyming couplets and quatrains, the entire chapter becomes a perfect epic poem. It can survive without the normal prose. And my editors didn't even find that one. That was written on purpose as sort of a love letter to a certain structure where a lot of the old epics were written as an epic poem originally. And later people started translating and normalizing them and adding normalized prose. And I wanted to create that too because it's just important in the context of that world for authenticity as much as it is for the readers to get that little nesting story for their entertainment. But you don't have to do that if you don't want or didn't know to. Like, it still works without doing that extra step. So I wanted the novel to have at least a present and past accessible story, and then layers of stuff that hopefully, if you are the kind of person who wants to go back and look for stuff, there's stuff to find which will hopefully enrich the experience even more for you.
Yeah, for me it's also interesting seeing the pictures in the background of the map for the first book.
Oh,
that yes. You have those, and that's like something that you also can easily miss on a glance. Mm-hmm. But like I really do love maps, and for me it's really good that they are like back in style. And I've seen a lot of recent books have been doing maps, and I know that can be like costly for some people. That's one of the reasons that people don't do them. But I love them, and things like that can also bring the world to life even more.
And there's secrets in the map too. I have no problem saying that too. The map reveals a lot of secrets about a lot of the story.
And how was the process of building a map? Like, how did the process of working with the artist look like? Did you know, like, do you give a draft? Like, how was your brief look like?
So I actually did my own draft when I was first writing the first book, which I actually did send to the map maker, who I'm very fortunate to know in real life. I knew her before I even wrote the series. Her name is Priscilla Spencer. In fact, she now works for Dragonsteel and Brandon Sanderson. She did the map for Jim Butcher's Codex of Alera. She has a great website. I can't remember every author she's done it for, but she's done it for a lot of traditionally published authors. And now she's Team Sanderson. And working with her was an absolute delight. I was able to show her my draft, what I wanted, my influences of how cultures looked, and we talked personally in direct messages every day. So it was a great process to refine it, and she took my ideas and was able to raise them even further of how to include certain secrets and stuff in art references that I never even thought about. It was actually her idea to make the map more sepia-toned and make it look like that very ancient style, which I thought was extremely beautiful, and it added a different layer to it. And it was her idea to actually show the Golden Road, because I had the path. I never thought about sharing that with the reader, to be honest. It was just in my mind, so I had it for distance and location and the roads, and then she actually took it when I just showed her just so she understood, and she overlaid it into the actual world, so now you have all the trade routes, at least by land, which added a different depth, I think, because it's such a trade and traveling story-based story as well.
Yeah, for sure. I believe that, like, the visual aspect of it, and also your covers, which I really love, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
That they do make it come to life. Of course, you don't want to make it like a graphic novel. You wrote a book, but still, I think those things really add to the atmosphere and like help the reader. And I see that, like, a lot of people also who are fortunate enough to do the deluxe editions of their work also include some illustrations as well. And you, as you said, you're like at the beginning, you have your hardbacks, which were really, really like hitting with people, but also the paperbacks that are more accessible. But have you thought about, or is it still early in the series to think about like those maybe even more like broad editions with illustrations and more things in them?
I've always wanted to, believe it or not. I've talked to certain artists, and I have just for my own passion, like certain layouts of what it would look like. Unfortunately, and I wasn't aware of this when I signed the contract. So my publishers have the special edition rights. I actually don't. So it's going to be up to them for the first three books. I don't know how it works with getting them back, so one day I could do it. In other novels of mine, if I do self-published stuff in the future in fantasy or with new publishers, I'm definitely going to make it a point to keep those, because if publishers aren't using them, I don't see the point in sitting on them. And I believe in what Sanderson's doing, which is what is just a great nod not only to readers but just the book-loving culture, is that people genuinely want books to also be works of art and collectibles. I don't know any reader who doesn't appreciate these beautiful special editions, even regardless of their cost. Even just looking at them, the labor of love that goes into them, it's an added value, and book collectors are exactly that. They're book collectors, right? They're going to spend money on that. They're not book collectors who also go below like $1,000 or something, or on something else. If books are their thing, that's what they're going to spend on, and I believe in giving them that added value for a series they really love. So I do hope I get to do it someday in the future with other works of mine, and hopefully Tales of Tremaine will get some other special editions. I have been fortunate in that both Goldsboro and The Broken Binding have been doing their versions of the special editions for launch editions.
And working with your publisher, for me, it's interesting because a lot of people I talk with on Storyline Sessions are self-published indie. And like from your side of things, how is your experience so far? And what do you think like, going forward, does it have its merits still for you? Or like when you, of course, you don't want to bash your publisher, but like thinking about when the trilogy is done, have you thought about like maybe going your separate way?
So for me, I'm kind of a problem child in publishing too, because I write really fast for at least the traditional side, because I come from indie. So traditional timelines have kind of hurt me in that non-competes and stuff make it really hard, because I was full-time and I'm working and this is my income. The delays with book two have kind of actually really hurt my income in some ways, even though the book's earning well. It's forced me to consider a lot. Like, I actually started a new pen name, which is public, and I'm actually selling. I have a crime and thriller novel on submission right now, hopefully to diversify and expand my career. What I'm hoping ideally with this is that book two launches really well, which so far early pre-orders seem like it's on a good track, that I can renew Tales of Tremaine with Tor, because this was a larger than three book series. It's done in arcs, and I like to hopefully sell books 4, 5, and 6 to them, and continue that relationship, and then hopefully have freedom to try writing other stuff, both traditional and indie. I genuinely believe in the diversity of an author's career, having a foot in both, because I don't know how it is all over across the world, but I want to assume it's gotten harder for everybody. People I've talked to in different countries, from the UK, South Asia, everything, like, inflation's happening all over the world. Money's getting tighter and harder. It's just uncertain times, and I think the more different ways you can just have to get income doing what you love is not a bad thing. Like, with traditional publishing, when you're on royalties, you get paid twice a year. That's reliable in that you know you're going to get paid twice a year, but that's not as helpful as sometimes having predictable monthly income. Because you don't know what you're going to make on your royalties until you get the statement. But with Amazon, for example, you have a lifetime dashboard. You can sort of estimate what you're going to get paid next month, the month after that, the previous month. You can check. You have more control in your marketing, and the same with the audio. I know I want to keep an open hybrid path just because this is my job and my day life, right? Like, I just need to make sure I'm making money to support myself so I can keep writing for fans. It feels weird because that feels like it's a very hostile answer sometimes at the industry. Because I know coming from indie, I came back from 2013 when I watched the traditional side kind of talk very down and negatively towards indie authors. And maybe I'm just still in this weird PTSD mindset of, it feels like if you bring up anything that might not be ideal about traditional, you're sort of like punching back. But it's more just, I've seen so many shifts even in the last few years. I just want to make sure that myself, my friends, whether they're indie, traditional, or hybrid, have the opportunity to keep making a living doing what they're living. Because the industry is always going to change, right? Like, people didn't think MP3s were going to be a thing in the music industry, and then they did. And then they had streaming music, and then self-publishing happened with SoundCloud. And now there's entire SoundCloud labels and independent artists making just as much as some maybe major label ones. And I'm just in support of anything that allows an author or any artist to be safe financially.
Yeah, for sure. And it's been an upward trend. Fortunately, people are getting access to a lot of different means to get their work out there. And hearing that from you, I think that, like, a lot of people have been a bit hesitant to talk about that, because you still got some, like, maybe prejudice about art and money. People are like, you're an artist, you shouldn't think about the money. Right. But the people want to get your work in front of them, and if you're, like, struggling to even, like, keep the lights on, it's really hard to get quality work. And now that it is your work, how would you compare it to a while back when you were just, like, starting off? How did it change for you?
Wow. Man, that's shocking, because, like, in some ways it's really hard to remember the artist that I was, because when I started, there's so much that's happened. Like, I started at a distance where I idolized authors like Jim Butcher. Mm. And I my only interaction with him was at a book signing in 2011. And he didn't know me. And I've shared the story before. It was a very emotional, a great, important moment in my life. But then I didn't interact with him again until I had self-published like 2 to 3 books already. And then again, it was like, hey, cool. And I got up for the same award with him, the Dragon Award in 2016 for Best Paranormal Fantasy Novel of the Year, which was cool. And then years later, he actually took me under his wing as a mentor. I was a student and he's a mentor. And the transition of just that many changes and how much my craft has changed learning things and then learning more things from him. The first binding at the time was a project I kind of wished when I started I'd always been able to write, but I didn't have the skills to. And in learning to write that, I developed the skills. And now it's kind of shocking going back and looking at my own work, because as much as I love it, and I still am going to continue like the Grave Report and other series, I just haven't had time because I've been committed to this on contract. It's very interesting rereading it, because it's hard to reread it only as a fan now. Because when I first wrote it, I was just a fan of the work and what I wanted to create. And now there's so much difference in my craft where I'm like, I could have probably done this and it would have been even better or even cooler. But there's the learning of something else that Jim taught me is that you got to learn to like leave books alone. Because especially with self-published, there's a need, and I know some who've done it, where you can go back and rewrite it to be even better, but then you can fall into a trap of constantly trying to make it better instead of going like, I see what I could have done better there for the next book. But then that's the answer. You just take that and make book 4, book 5 even better now. So readers have that journey with you. There's a linear progression of, wow, the first 3 books were pretty good. They're like, holy crap, book 4 is even better, and book 5 is even better. Because that's what happens even within, hopefully, a normal series, like Tales of Tremaine. I worked really hard to make sure book 2 was better than book 1. And then if you do that in series, I feel like the blessing and reward of that is you can go back to older stuff, and if it's a series, just make the future books that much better because you have the craft and appreciation now to do that.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned the award. You also were, if I'm not mistaken, the finalist for the Nebula Award. Yes. Yeah, and a couple more. And how did that feel? I mean, like, did you were you expecting that? Did you submit it yourself, or how does that work?
We weren't expecting it at all. It was kind of a shock because I remember I got an email from a CIFO coordinator and my co-writer for that, Yudhanjaya Wijaratne, because we wrote this as a love letter and a critique of Pacific Rim, and more the idea that whenever giant aliens attack, they always attack America, which never made sense because I'm like, aliens wouldn't understand necessarily like what country's a superpower if they're just attacking, especially like aliens like the Kaiju in there, which don't seem to have math and computers. So if an alien invasion happened, they would probably look at population density, we thought, which would be China and India in terms of sheer population. Like, if we're going to hurt humanity, go for the most amount of people. And we wrote that together, and then he's in Sri Lanka and I'm in America. So I got this email one day, and he was asleep, and it was telling us that we were finalists. So I just exploded, freaking out, like trying to email him, like, hey, wake up. I know he's asleep. But I was like, try to text him and call him, like, dude, wake up. And it completely freaked us out, and we had no idea that was going to happen, and it was just like a week of shock. But then we didn't get to process it because we sort of felt this giant pressure, because when it happened, everyone was retweeting it over Twitter, like, congratulations to all the nominees and stuff. And then we started worrying, like, what does it mean? Do things change? Like, should we start considering going traditional now? Because we weren't at that time, and we didn't think we were going to, just because of life and writing commitments. Because the year that we got that, I was already on planning to launch and had launched 3 books. I had published Beast Queen, Star Shepherd, and Grave Tidings, 3 books in a year already, and I was just beginning to germinate more of the ideas for Tales of Tremaine, which originally was going to be indie. I was going to write it like a Patreon kind of thing, like episode by episode, like a serial, because picaresque. And that year, I don't think I got to enjoy the Nebula at all, really, besides the initial shock, because when we got to the convention, it was so much like networking stuff that we weren't used to being indies. I saw people like doing like handshakes and stuff, like, oh, I was in this writing seminar and this writing class, and I just kind of felt like this weird outsider watching this happen. Like, everybody knew each other from like different seminars and stuff and whatever, and writing classes, and I didn't know many people, and it was kind of overwhelming. And then I bumped into all these agents there, including one who would eventually become mine, and they were sort of like approaching me, which I wasn't used to. And then that felt like it put more pressure on, because I was working on projects to sell and everything, and that was the year that led to the sale of Tales of Tremaine. So my history with awards has been really, really weird. Like, the first year when I got the Dragon Award nomination, I wasn't able to go to Dragon Con because I didn't know about it. So I found out about the award before Dragon Con. I was kind of ignorant because I wasn't, again, self-published. I didn't go to conventions yet. I really didn't know too much about the convention scene. I'd heard about them, but I was working class, you know, kind of poor. At that time, I still had my day job where I was a mechanic, and I didn't expect it. So the first award kind of missed me by. It was really cool online. Didn't get to go. The next year, I made a point to go. And they've sort of just been different stepping stones of introducing me more to, I guess, the community, more than even the award itself. Every award's just opened me up to more people, which has been really cool.
And now from this perspective, what did you say to someone in your position from those years, how they should approach it? Of course, everybody's path is different, but like some key points you wish you did at that time.
I think I wish I'd even... I'm trying to phrase this properly because I don't want to sound dismissive, but it's something a lot of people I've looked up to have sort of told me is, don't worry about the awards and don't let them get to you emotionally. Anyways, even wanting them. Because the nature of awards changes so much, and this might be contentious, but recently it came out, well, what happened with the Hugo Awards. And I was told, like, and this goes back to some of the fears and stuff I've had to struggle with in my life, of what you said, you have to keep the lights on. And they go, I had it reduced really down to, if you want to do this full-time and you want to give your readers books, you have to make sure your bills are paid, and awards don't pay bills. That's unfortunately true in anything. There have been Nobel Prize winners who have died, unfortunately, penniless, which is really sad. But it's like an extra mental task, and maybe everyone handles it differently. For me, I just think it doesn't help me mentally thinking about them. It's easier for me if I'm already having to pay bills and stuff and work to just go, let me just get the work done. Let me just focus on the work. Because the only thing I can guarantee is moments like this with you, where I can create the work and then have a discussion with the reader. That's the only thing I'm really promised. I'm not even technically promised the money. Worrying about being promised an award, trying to figure those out and stuff, is so much more mental stress that I could use just going, how do I make book three better? And that might not be the best answer for everybody. I just think for me, with what I juggle, how I can focus my mind, my ADHD, reducing it, my career and my concerns down to something that lets me focus on everything that I need, just keeping it on the work and hoping it sells is probably the best for me, at least.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's like a valid point for a lot of people. And speaking of book three, I know we are just getting to the book two, but we've danced around a bit. You said that there are arcs you would like to see even to the book six or maybe beyond. But what's in it for Ari? Would we see his story end with the trilogy, or could you imagine him going even beyond that?
So his story does not end with the trilogy, but there is a really, again, like a catharsis. There's a really good point that at least with some of the past story and the present gives you that you realize Ari reaches some point of catharsis. He's achieved something that he needs to achieve, and it sets up the larger story of things he still needs to do. Not to compare, because it's not the exact same kind of story, but I guess a really good example still is The Dragon Reborn. I don't know the truth of everything with the history of the series, because I've heard so many stories from people inside, but it's been said a lot. Originally, it was never supposed to be like a 12-book series. It was supposed to be maybe a trilogy, then five, and it kept getting bigger and bigger because of the success. But you can see how Dragon Reborn, no matter what, sets up enough of a first three-book act that it could have ended in terms of Rand fulfills the prophecy to the world in terms of at least the dragon has been reborn. The third book is that culmination. He goes through the steps of the audience realizes in book one he's the dragon when Moraine says it. Book two, we see him have the giant battle in the sky that sort of announces the dragon coming back to enough people in the world. By three, he draws Kalendor. He fulfills the prophecy of, like, now we really know that the dragon is here. I kind of structured Tales of Tremaine to be every three or maybe four, and sometimes a duology depending on the length of the series, that there's enough of a key point moment that is an emotional catharsis of the books before it. So books one, two, and three hit a certain point, but Ari's journey is not done. But there's enough of a, this is a really good ending. We feel fulfilled. A lot of the promises we were told have been kept. And that's what I'm sort of aiming at throughout the series, throughout the different chunks that contain each other. So you get more and building up more, but the series isn't going to be done, but you're going to feel satisfied with book three.
That's awesome. And before I let you go, because we are talking about the second book that's soon to come, and when people will be hearing this, we'll be just short of the launch. So what was like some of the maybe most fun moments for you that won't be exactly spoilers, but something that you can tease towards to people who have read the first book, and what should they look forward to?
Definitely building off and paying off a lot of the myths in small little sections, like riddle rhymes and poetry that people might not have thought was important in book one, or insignificant throwaway lines, and seeing how they build up in book two, like where the title comes from, like what's actually happening, the mythology, seeing more of Ari's legends that maybe I'd already set up and teased in book one, and you get a new appreciation for when you read book two, and definitely the consequences of stuff from book one, where maybe it looks like I forgot about them, but then you find out I didn't, and Ari might have forgot about them because he's just a kid in the past. And kids are really impulsive, and they get wrapped up in their own head. And he gets a few sobering lessons. And getting to play with that and paying stuff back off was really, really fun.
That's awesome. And I'm sure that people will love it. And I can't wait to see everything pan out. And yeah, I wish you all the success with the launch, and hopefully with the rest of the series. So we'll be keeping an eye out. And yeah, for sure, we'll share everything with people as the time comes, when the time for the launch comes. Also with the news, with all the additions. So fingers crossed it goes super well. And I'm sure it will be.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ronnie, for coming on to Storyline Sessions, and yeah, I'll see you around.
All right, man, thank you for having me.
Thanks, bye. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find Ronnie and his work using the links below. Also, if you're interested in creative writing and storytelling in any kind of media, keep following the Storyline Sessions, both here and on Instagram. Also, TikTok coming soon, keep an eye out. My name is Marko Bogdanović, and I'll see you next time. Keep creating stories.